Welcome to the Best People We Know radio show. This is where you'll meet experts and celebrities who share their success secrets with you to help you be your most successful best, too. Your host, Deb Scott, is a certified professional coach at Discover the Amazing You Coaching and author of the award-winning motivational book, The Sky is Green and the Grass is Blue, Turning Your Upside-Down World Right Side Up. The Best People We Know radio show brings you powerful resources, effective ideas, and transformational tools you can use to educate, inspire, and motivate you to be your most purposeful, peaceful, happy best. So get ready to experience mind vitamins to feed your whole soul. Good change is about to happen. The Best People We Know radio show. Here's your host, Deb Scott.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome. It's a new week, September 12th. Wow, if you were like me, you were gripped at the TV yesterday for September 11th, looking at the new memorial. And, you know, for so many of us, it seems just like yesterday. And then there's a whole group of people that weren't even, you know, around to remember any of it. They weren't even born yet. It's just unbelievable, but went to some beautiful ceremonies and being here in Boston and thinking about those planes leaving from here. I know that we all remember where we were when that happened, and our prayers and love go out to those families that on a regular basis every day deal with 9/11. You know, towards that end, life, the gift of life, the caregiving, elderly. I mean, it's just such a gift to be able to grow old, isn't it? Or it, even if you have an illness, having somebody there that really loves and cares about you. And our guest today is really an expert. He's an attorney, but he's focusing out of his own personal experience as a cancer survivor in dealing with end-of-life issues. So if you have a question for Tim, you can call 347-637-1318, 347-637-1318, and we'll be bringing him on air in just a second, and I'm going to read his bio for you as well. I just wanted to remind you that call-in coaching is starting this month, and I've been getting a lot of great feedback. People seem to be very excited about it. This month's lesson is going to be on dumping the drama. So if you or someone you know has someone that's always, you know, a family member, a coworker, always seems to be in a crisis or always seems to be some major drama going on, then you probably want to attend this. And it's free. It's going to be Saturday the 24th. If you go to my website, greenskyandbluegrass.com, there's all sorts of information, sign up details and everything. And I hope you'll be able to join us because I really think this is going to be an amazing, amazing event. So let me tell you about our guest today, Tim Tosta. He is a prominent California attorney. He's also a cancer survivor, and he's also a hospice volunteer, so he has a lot of firsthand experience and knowledge on this subject. He offers his personal insights on how to discuss death and support loved ones through the cycle of this very, you know, it's a part of life. Death is a part of life in this issue. In his most recent book, Death Tweet, O2, A Perspective on Being a Supportive Witness to the End of Life, is available on Amazon, Books A Million, BarnesandNoble.com. He offers healing and inspiration in this second book of his to everyone involved in the end of life process, which I really think touches each one of us listening. It offers a rich and heartwarming view of the final transformation. Prodded by cancer and the heart-opening experience of his hospice work, Tim became an integral coach, helping members of the legal profession and businesses in their communities to lead purposeful, balanced, thriving lives. And Tim blogs frequently. He's a guest blogger as well on life and death issues at www.coachingcouncil.com. and I would recommend that you go there and get to know him. And it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce everybody to Tim Tosta. Hi, Tim. How are you doing today?
It's a beautiful day in paradise out here in the Bay Area. I'm doing great. Thank you. And thank you for having me on.
Well, it's a privilege and a pleasure, and I love what you're doing and what you're about, and you're really walking your talk, and you're dealing with an issue that we all have to face. I mean, part of life is death, and you know, I think yesterday was a real it just seemed to be timing, perfect timing, I guess, in having you on today. But we all, you know, race, age, gender, none of us are exempt from suffering, from illness, from death, from dying, but you really help us deal with these things in a graceful way, in a positive way, in an inspirational way. But I think the best way to start out this morning is for you to just share a little bit about yourself with the reader, with the listeners, so that we can relate to you better in knowing where you've come from.
Well, I'm a 62-year-old lawyer. I've been practicing. I think I entered my 38th year of law this year, and I was a budding, young, talented, up-and-coming lawyer in San Francisco. I had my own firm. My work is the work of an environmental and land use lawyer. So California's got a really tough regulatory regime for getting new buildings built, and I found a knack for being able to work within the system and bring projects online. And I just had a colossal practice, and I was totally dominated by my work. And at age 41, I received a call from my dermatologist to the effect that the tumor that I had insisted be reexamined because there was just something wrong with this lump that was in my back. I was told there was no problem. I had the slide sent up to the University of California, San Francisco, and the word had come back that, contrary to what they had originally told me, that it was a non-cancerous tumor, as it had always been a cancerous tumor and had been allowed to grow for 6 years. And the doctor sputtered out to me in a a horribly emotional but not well thought out message that I probably had 2 years to live. And I
Wow. Yeah, I can't even imagine what that, you know, and I just wanted to pause because, I mean, that just grabbed me. And I'm sure that there's somebody listening, somebody else, a family member they know. You had your life going on autopilot by all worldly standards. You were super successful. This law practice was great. And here you are getting this prognosis that you probably have just like 2 years to live, and here you are in your early 40s. I mean, wow. Okay, tell us what happened next.
Well, it's kind of a shot to the gut. It took I had 3 kids under 9 at that point. And I had really spent the greater part of my life working toward some unspecific future date. I actually would say to people, this is so stunning to me when I think about it, I'd say, I'll get to life later. Can you imagine?
Wow.
I'll get to life later. I've got this to do now. You know, I got out of college. I went into law school. I opened my own law practice right after. I just didn't take time off. I married a wonderful woman and had 3 delightful children, and I was going to get to them later. Absurd. But then you get into the question of, well, now that you know you have this very limited amount of time, what do you do with it? I mean, how do you use your 2 years? As it turned out, following the initial surgery, it appeared that despite the depth of the tumor, it hadn't metastasized. It hadn't gone into the bloodstream. So I was told instead of 2 that in about 7 years, if I hadn't had another tumor, they would consider it a cure. So it was kind of a commuted sentence. So I moved from the 2-year horizon to the 7-year horizon, which just seemed colossal. And the question is, okay, so what do I do with this precious time? And it was really, they sent me to a shrink, you know.
I think we'd all be doing that. Hello, I would say
yeah.
So.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is that you know, psychologists generally are no more prepared to deal with end of life issues or short life issues is that they're just not ready. We all suffer from this inordinate fear of dying. And conversations around it are at best awkward. And so I went off and I kind of put my own program together. I studied psychology on my own. I studied philosophy and comparative religions. And I just really went into the depth of what makes humans human and what it is about us that is worthy. And I was kind of searching for the right, I guess I had a sense that I would know it when I found it, whatever it was I was supposed to do. And so I, first thing I did is I picked up musical instruments again, which I had left, upon entry of law school. I put away music. What a remarkable thing. I played all the time before, and then I just put it away. So I started playing music again. And then I rediscovered yoga and started meditating, and somewhere along the path, a friend of mine who is a former Buddhist monk introduced me to Zen Hospice Project, which is a nonprofit that trains people to work with the dying. And I was trained to work at a public hospital in San Francisco where we work with the city's most disenfranchised populations. We work with homeless people and people released on compassion leave from prison or people who are newly immigrated to the United States and have no medical protection. And I just sat with people as they died. And that kind of seems, saying that sounds, it doesn't really tell you anything, but what happens is you can't help but open yourself up. You can't help but open your heart when you're sitting with someone dying. And you find that you have, had good training, but you're never really trained for what happens when you're sitting at the bedside. And I just found myself able to be with people. And it didn't take me down, rather it lifted me up because I actually felt like I was being confident in their presence. I was able to assist. I was really making a difference, which was something that I'd felt in different points of my life and career, but this was just so real and so profound that it shaped my week. It became kind of my church. So I work on Monday nights from 5 to 10. It's my eighth year of working as a hospice volunteer. I can't tell you how many people I've sat with as a guy. But we have a 26-bed ward. And it's just a profound thing, and it's changed everything in my life. It's really completely changed my life.
Wow. And I think that, the irony is that, we're all going to die and anybody can die, but not everybody lives. And what I'm hearing you talk about is volunteering the compassionate care that you have for these people working in the hospice, knowing your own limitations, being, really hit in the face with your own mortality in a way that many of us will never experience, and just being able to really embrace life because of your interaction with death. And I just think that's really an irony that's amazing, but you have so much to share about that, and you have done that in your books. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, some of the things that you've discovered. I can hear, the fun, the music, and the appreciation in the present moment. But some of the top 3 to 5 things that listeners can expect to learn when they read your books, and some of the things that you think we all need to remind ourselves this day, especially with what we've gone through with 9/11, I think, it's really, really pivotal and timely.
Well, I've written 2 books, and not being like the most creative artist, I named them Death Tweet 1 and Death Tweet Book 2. So Death Tweet 1 deals with lessons that the dying people have taught me, and they really revolve around 5 things. It's change, control, perception, discovery, and relationship. And by that, I mean when people are dying, they are experiencing inordinate change, and they learn to adapt to it. And the fact is, in our lives, we're always facing inordinate change, but we're not good at adapting to it. And we suffer because we want the world to stay the same, and by definition, it doesn't. The second issue then becomes, and the dying people experience this, you lose control. You lose control of your bladder. You lose control of your ability to eat. You lose control of some of your cognitive capability. Those things that you lose control of, you can't regain, so why go after it? Why spend the precious moments available to you chasing something that's beyond your reach? And we do that all the time in life. They're just things that we're not going to control. You know, the deviant sibling. You have these relationships that are just not likely to change until you let go of trying to control them. The third is perception, because the way we view the world gets stuck, and we lose our creativity and our ability to see the world in a different way. But dying people know that they're in precious time, and they start to shift their perceptions and see things that they've taken for granted in a different way, or things that they were really stuck on, they find a way to let go. The fourth, then, is discovery, because once you change your perceptions, your ability to discover things that are incredible, that we've always been in front of you, opens up. And the last is relationship, which is, at the end of life, the only thing that really matters is how well did you love. And that's another lesson that we can begin right now.
Mm.
So those are really kind of major, major themes I saw again and again in working with the dying. Now, the second book is really kind of a reversal of that. When you're sitting at the end of someone's life, and there's a tendency to bring all your junk with you to the bedside. And really what that does is it makes the end of someone else's life more difficult, because you're so loaded with your own anxiety, your own anguish, your own desire to seek resolution with the person that's dying, that you actually bring a load into their room and you ask them to help you work on it, where it should be the exact opposite. You should be a vessel to help them, to carry them through this last period. And I'm not saying that you bring that stuff to the bedside because you want to. You just can't help it. So my second book is about releasing yourself, making yourself fully available, opening your heart, giving you the assurance that even though this is a novel occasion, it's something where you might not feel confident, that essentially you're an incredible human being, and all human beings have the capacity to be at the bedside of someone else, because it's just about being available. It's about being open. It's about being supportive of someone at the end of life. And we all know how to do it. It's just that we bring a package of beliefs to the bedside that makes it hard to know that. Makes it hard to know that.
I love your 5 points from the first book: the change, the control, the perception, discovery, and relationship. And that, you know, all we really keep is the love. And the being fully available as a follow-up in the second book, because if I have a gift for someone, or someone has a gift for me, if I'm holding on to something else, I can't receive that gift. I can't take it in my hands. We really have to let go of the things that aren't serving us to make room for the things that will. And, you know, I'm really struck by you sharing with us the verbiage that you were just, you know, you had the great family, you had the kids, the wife, the job, and you were like, well, I'm going to deal with that later. And so many things, times we can be busy, but are we being busy? Are we making a choice to be busy with those things that really matter, that we will take with the end? And I think that your wisdom and the things that you share in your book and your talks and your blogs gives us an opportunity to live with you, living vicariously through you, things that we might not experience, but now we can because of what you've shared. And do you have a particular routine during your day right now that you'd like to share with people listening, something that they might be able to implement immediately to embrace this new way of thinking that you've given us?
Well, one of the things that comes to me in sitting with the people that I sit with, I'm a white man in the baby boomer generation. I was raised in a small town in an upper middle class household. The thing that really struck me when I started working with people that lived on the streets, that people that had mental health issues, people that were released from prison, and I'm sitting with them at the end of life, was they're all just like me. And there was, I hadn't really thought about how I lived in my own little bubble. You know, I went to a wonderful undergraduate education. I went to law school. So I've kind of always been in this predominantly white elite culture. And that was just shattered by the volunteer work. But there was no time for a reaction. I'm sitting with a dying person. What difference does it make where they came from? And then I began to listen to their stories. And, you know, I'd always thought about the word love as being reserved for family or for intimate friends and coming out of a sexual relationship, and it's your wife or your girlfriends or whatever. Love is something that doesn't really have much to do with that at all. Love is the capacity to take someone in and hold them. And I was at a talk yesterday in San Diego, and I said I fall in love about every 15 minutes, because I've essentially changed my view from crossing a street to avoid the person who is trying to get money in a styrofoam cup, to being at the bedside with that person when they die and being able to see into the incredible person that they are. So what I do is I just let my judgments go. I don't hold on to them anymore. In fact, I'm trying to shed them at an unbelievable pace, because when you see someone and you have no prejudice about what they might be and you really open yourself up to listen to them, more often than not, you find something you can love. And once you've done that, not only does it change who you are, they perceive you differently and they start to meet you where you see them. That is, if I thought they were small and petty and mean-spirited, that's what I'd see and that's what they'd be. But if you start to hold a space for them where you see them as potentially an incredible human being, that's where they'll find you. So it's kind of putting on a new mindset. It's being available for every person to be. You know, and that, think about that in a lawyer's context. I mean, I'm across the table negotiating with people, and most lawyers come into the room with an attitude and a goal, and they really don't see one another as humans across the table. But I've changed the way I practice law, and I've changed the way I get outcomes just by being available to the people who I'm told are my opponents, but I don't see them that way.
Wow. I tell you, and I can hear the piece. I mean, you really do enjoy your own company. I can hear it in your voice, and it's really a testimony to anybody, whether you're a lawyer or you're in some sort of a practical business that you think can have a sense of spirituality, a purpose. Really, everything has purpose. We all have purpose. Each person is worthwhile, and I love how you share about the person on the side of the street, and then you're there with them, you know, helping them as they leave here. And that's got to be something that I mean not everybody could do the volunteer work you're doing, but it really seems to have opened opportunities for new insights that you might not have gotten in any other way.
Well, I think actually everybody could do the work, and I'm hoping, because, you know, we're at a really extraordinary moment in terms of the demographics of the world. I mean, the baby boomers are a big deal. They're a huge population, and they're all aging very rapidly. I mean, we're kind of beginning to see the end of this generation. And death is going to be around us for another 20 years. I mean, in a different way than it has been in the past, just because of the age that's coming. And there's a remarkable thing about going back to death. I was in the audience yesterday. There was a Hispanic woman who was asking me, whatever happened to leaving death in our culture? Why did we push it away? Because what we used to live in multi-generational households, so when grandpa died, he often died in the home, and death was a part of what happened in the home. And we've taken it out of the home, and we put it in an institution, and then we've hidden it, and we've sanitized it. And a great, great disservice is done not only to the person dying, but to the family members who don't get to see this extraordinary transition. I was with my mother as she took her last breath. I spoke to my father about 20 minutes before he died. It's a completion. It's an act of completion. It's a passing on of the mantle of their lives to you. You know, when someone you love dies and you've been with them, you carry them forward, irrespective of what you believe from a religious standpoint. We all get to carry a piece of someone forward who we cared for, because they become embedded in you. And making yourself...
I love what you're saying. How do you define death for somebody now in light of, you know, what you just said, especially about generations dying with their families at home, and it just, death was so different. And you're right, it's almost like we want to take it out of our culture, and what we need to do is exactly the opposite. How would you tell somebody who has a real fear of death or afraid of dying, or has someone that has just died and they have anger, or maybe they're, you know, dealing with their own diagnosis, such as you experienced, what would you like to tell that person? How can they define it and reframe it and befriend it so that it can be a positive opportunity to live in a better way?
Well, I think that just coming to acknowledge your mortality is a really important step, because this is the controlling the uncontrollable. I mean, we're all going to die. We're all going to die, but it's a question of how are we going to die, in what state are we going to die. I've gotten to the point now in my life where I can see someone, and I think if they were to die in the next half hour, how would they die? And unfortunately, you can start to tell who's going to be able to leave easily and who's going to leave hard, just because of the way they're carrying themselves, the energy they have in their bodies, the kind of, there's just a, I think the word is umwelt. It's like, how is their whole being held? And it's a horrible thing for people like me that can see that in an instant, because you see how people are living in pain. And so the idea is to try and take that that tension, that rigidity, and find a way to release it. And one of the ways to begin to release it is just to acknowledge that you're only here for a while, so why don't you do the best you can with what you've got? And why not bring us, you know, the number of people that have sat in their final hours or final minutes, and that what they've spoken about is how they love people. I mean, you know, you're not going to take your material goods. You're not going to take the story that you've made of yourself. You know, we all tell ourselves stories about who we are. At the end of life, you talk about who you cared for. You don't care who you are. So, look, if you're telling your story right now, I mean, how much love is in it? How much do you really care for other people? You can do an incredible job. You can be a titan of industry. You can be an Academy Award-winning actor. But the question is, how do you care for people? You know, all of us can do everything we're doing right now, perhaps, with a great deal more awareness to how we take care of ourselves and others. Maybe some of us would have to give up our jobs if we focused on that, because we aren't doing anything. And I also see those people. In fact, in my legal career, I've worked for a very large number of extraordinarily wealthy healthy people, and they're some of the most unhappy people I've ever worked with.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, it just, well, you know, I mean, it switches from trying to make it to trying to keep it. Or, materialism is not a high-functioning mindset. You need only so much. And I think it's wonderful to create a business and try and turn it into, you know, a great service to humanity or a great product. But there's got to be an ability to relate to the humans that are engaged with you in that activity and the customers you're serving or the people to whom you're providing service. And it went, you know, the great companies know that and the great companies show that. Mm-hmm. And you can be in business and you can be an extraordinary human being.
But I think that's a question that you've just shared that we can all ask ourselves right now. You know, how are we making a difference? And a lot of us do that in our careers and jobs, but a lot of us don't. I know, speaking of 9/11, I was watching the documentary yesterday, the one of the millions on, and there was an interview with a man who was in one of the towers who did get out, obviously alive, and he was in business, and he was in a fast-paced business working at the World Trade Center. And one of the things that he said when he, you know, was blessed to come out alive was, you know, what am I doing with my life? And he switched, he went into nursing, and that's not to say that, you know, everybody needs to be out of business and doing something else, but he just decided, he said his thoughts in that moment of how he was going to leave his life, he didn't want the next time that to be, the, you know, he didn't want those thoughts the next time around. He had an opportunity to change it. And what he realized, having almost died in the Trade Center, was that he knew what mattered was making a difference for other people. Hence, he changed his career to do that. And, you know, I'm hearing what you're saying. It's so much of what we need to do is not wait till that time comes when we get the bad news or, you know, we're on our deathbed. You know, the time to perform arrives, the time to prepare is past. And I think in your books, what you offer people the opportunity to ask the questions now before they're in that crisis, right? Because ultimately, you're going to live better.
Yeah, let me tie that back to 9/11, because one of the things that that's really important for folks to know is it doesn't take long for the realization of why you were put on the planet to come to you. And most of the people I work with have the grace of a period of knowing you're going to die before they do die, so they have the chance to go back through and understand their life in context. Some people don't get that. Some people are in a tall building that's hit by a plane, and they die much quicker. But what I've learned in watching people is that the dawning of why they were there, the dawning of their significance, can happen in an instant. So that the fact that they don't have a long time to contemplate the end of life doesn't necessarily mean they didn't see the point of it.
Mm.
And you'll never really know in those horrific situations, someone's hit by a bus, someone is shot randomly, what their final passing was, but there is this moment of knowing that you're passing, I think, that I've seen again and again, and that peace that people describe is a moment of realization. And it may defy our ability to characterize or put language on, but there is this kind of realization that, I'm being released into what I was, you know, I'm being released. I use two large metaphors in that tweet, too. One is, I described the witness, that's the person at the bedside, as being a hero, because they're really going to a place they've never been before, and they're going to go through the ordeals or the challenges of the other person dying, but they'll come back a changed person. That's a traditional hero story. On the person who's in the bed, the person who's dying, who I call the other has an enormous freedom that comes with the fact that you no longer have to carry all the things that they've carried through their entire lifetime about who they are, how they're seen, what they own, who, you know, they're just, there's all these things that we don't realize how weighty they are and how much they close us out from being in the world. But the dying people actually have an opportunity to be quietly aware of what's going on around them without a whole lot of ego in the way. Mm-hmm. And they actually find an enormous freedom in that. So ours is not to go in and judge how they are, but it's to make sure that the space we hold for them allows them the room to find that freedom. And it's in those moments, you know, even as buildings collapse, you hear stories of people that got people into the stairways. You find people being extraordinarily heroic in at the end of their lives because they knew what they were supposed to do. And so what I'm advocating for is if you sit at the bedside or if you're in the bed, make sure that you leave yourself the space to discover how incredible you are.
Wow. Wow. What, I tell you, what wisdom, what a gift. And it's just been, there's just so much more to know and to learn. And I love the questions that you ask. And without asking the right questions, you know, we won't get the right answers. And your insight is really, it's just brilliant. Before we go, I want to make sure that people know how to get your book and how to contact you and, you know, how to find you for your next event or anything that you have coming up in the future. So could you share that with people listening?
Well, the book is available at local bookstores, although most of you will probably have to special order it. There is also a link to happyabout.com is the publisher. You can get it there or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I blog twice a week at coachingcounsel.com. That's coaching and counsel is counsel.com/blog. And you can find me at ttosta@coachingcounsel.com. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk about this and hope that people walk away with at least the desire to discover how incredible they are. It's not an ego thing. It's kind of a relaxing into your greatness, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I love your sharing of we all have a purpose, and you know we owe it to ourselves and to others to take the time to reflect. And you know, you have some great ideas, some great resources in your book, and just looking forward to your next one. Do you have another one that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I'm actually working on Dog Tweet.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, so Dog Tweet came out of the same world. I watched animals being brought to the bedside, and I watched how dying people responded to animals. So Dog Tweet has a subtitle, What Our Dogs Teach Us About Being Human.
Oh, and, I love it. I love that. Oh, well, very clever.
Well, I'm a lawyer for the Peninsula Humane Society out here, and we have always had animals in our lives, and I think animals are great wisdom keepers. And I started with dogs because I tried to write a book on Pet Tweet, and I just realized, like, dogs and cats are so different. Got to start with one.
Yeah, so. I know. And I have my two. I have my two mini schnauzers, and I'm telling you, God and the dogs, unconditional love. I mean, they are just great.
They also teach you about that quietness. And they also teach you about judgment and not holding on to too much of that. It's really been fun. So it's really kind of it's an extension of what I've written before, but it's just putting it in a different.
And when will that be out, Tim?
I'm writing it right now, so I would suspect it'll be out early next year.
Oh well, we'll have to have you back on to talk about that because that'll be great.
All right.
Well, I really thank you for everything, and it's just been a really, talk about learning so much, and there's so much that we can take away right now, put into action. So those of you listening, if you've listened to Tim, you were, you know, your heart jumped out, and you're like, wow, that is what I needed to hear. Share this show with a friend and make sure that they can hear what you did, because that's how you keep us going and growing. You can connect with Tim, get one or both of his books, and, you know, sign up for his blogs and really keep this alive. Keep these things, you know, in your face, and make sure that you remember that part of living is knowing that we are going to die, but knowing that there are things that we can use and learn by facing it up front, as Tim shared with us, those lessons of, you know, giving up that control and those perceptions, and making sure that we take the time to love and do those things to make ourselves fully available. And don't wait. Start now.
Yeah, don't
do
wait
it now.
Live later.
That's right. Don't wait to live later, as you were saying. And the firsthand experience from walking the talk, I think, is always what this show is known for. And I know that you're doing that, Tim, and I know that listeners are going to learn a lot. I know that I have, and this is just the beginning. But it's a great day. It's a great way to start out the week. It's perfect timing, especially with what we've gone through yesterday as a nation at 9/11 and the world. And just thank you so very much for being with us, and looking forward to having you back on when you talk about, what was your subtitle again for the book?
Oh, What Dogs Teach Us About Being Human.
I love it. I love it. So we'll look forward to that, and that'll be a little bit lighter, but, you know, it's all really important stuff. So just want the listeners to know that you keep us going and growing. We've hit our one-year mark now with over 25,000 listeners, and I am just thrilled and just so grateful to be part of your life and bringing you great guests like Tim Tosta. So join us tomorrow. We're going to have a special show at 11 a.m. again, and you can join us for that. We look forward, if you do, download us on iTunes, give us a rating, and remember, in the famous words of Oscar Wilde, be yourself, because everybody else is already taken. Go out and make it a great day. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Best People We Know radio show with your host, Deb Scott. For more on Deb and her guests, plus her award-winning guidebook to transformation, The Sky is Green and the Grass is Blue, Turning Your Upside-Down World Right Side Up, go to Deb's website, greenskyandbluegrass.com. You can also connect with Deb for coaching or speaking, and sign up for Deb's free Mind Vitamin newsletter while you're there. So now, you're one step closer today to your greatness. We look forward to being with you next time on the Best People We Know radio show.